Right, we're here doing a discussion group with four teachers. Is history better taught today than when you were at school? Right, does anyone want to start?
Yes.
Is that the short answer?
It'd be the answer. But, you know, it's a difficult question to answer because there's a quotation by, I've forgotten who it's by, but it says all about technology, where basically the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. And it's the same with history teaching, isn't it? The fact that the future of history teaching is already around the country, it's just in pockets, you know, and there's obviously poor history teaching and good history teaching. I don't know about you, but when I was at school, it was very much textbook driven, and you still get that nowadays. It's just that it's supplemented with kind of e-learning stuff. It's supplemented with very rigorous kind of process and active learning, that type of stuff. But there still is very poor history teaching happening. And that's probably worse than when I was at school. Some of it will be worse than when I was at school. It just depends where you are and which teacher you happen to get, I suppose. But on the whole, I suppose it's better.
Are you sure it's worse where it's bad? How do you know that?
Because I've observed a teacher which was worse than my teacher when I was at school.
But perhaps you had a pretty good teacher, actually, when you were at school, comparatively.
I had a teacher who knew his subject very well and was, you know, could tell lots of stories and things, but in terms of me learning history, I don't think so much. And although I was interested in lessons, I've seen worse history teaching than that these days.
I suppose it depends on what history is for, and that's changed over time. I mean, you know, I'm obviously quite relatively recent within it. I mean, when curriculum, we were the second year to go in through the ASA2 structure, and I do remember we had two teachers at A level, one who was quite young, quite recognisably very similar to the kind of things that I then trained under when I went for PGC, one who was much more old school, believed that A-levels were preparation for university, that kind of argument. And they had a very different style of teaching. It was very mixed what we kind of got through from them and how far they embraced that curriculum change. Yeah, and that's what I always expected to be going into that kind of thing. But, you know, I've come in for my first year of teaching. The A-levels that I'll be looking at working in the future are very different than what I experienced, and that is within the last 5-10 years. Yeah. And it's, in terms of whether it's better today and whether, you know, what that means for the future, I think that's a very difficult kind of comparison to make, because actually needs definitions of what we see history to be is probably going to shift.
Yeah.
Are you saying that the curriculum itself determines whether it's good for students or not, or whether it's better taught or not?
Well, I've always been brought up under a curriculum. I mean, obviously, I know of days where there wasn't a national curriculum. I've read about that, but that to me is history. That
you're
is
right,
not
that's
a system
what you mean by
I've
better,
thought.
Doesn't it? And better to me, I don't know what you think, Diana, but to me, better history, well, good history is good history in 1850. And it's good history in 2050. You know, it's the means by which you go about doing that history which changes, and there's going to be different political factors and different contexts, like diplomas and, you know, this PLTS stuff. But at the end of the day, good history is good history, isn't it? It's getting a sense of the time. And
what makes the teaching good, then? If it's not so much the time, the circumstances, or the curriculum, what makes it good?
There's a quote by W.B. Yeats saying, "Education is not the filling of pails, but the lighting of fires." And basically, we have good teachers in school. They're the ones that are lighting fires in students. Okay, they mightn't light the fires in older students in their class, but they'll get a good proportion of them, and they will enjoy a subject. You will have students going on to university doing history just because they've had a very good history teacher that inspired them to do it. It could have easily been the case that if they were in a different class, they might have had a very good geography teacher. So it comes down to the ability of the teacher to inspire students to do a subject and do it well.
We're all here to some extent from having the fire lit at some point. In terms of whether it's better today than when we were at school, that there's a limit to what we can say about it.
It's a lot to do with personality, isn't it? But at the end of the day, I suppose what the question's getting at in terms of being better taught today is, does the context mean that the whole kind of history teaching profession is raised because of SHP conference, because of government initiatives, because of, you know, the different contexts within the educational system? And the answer is probably yes, isn't it? Because there's a much more focus on actual learning and process rather than dates and outcomes and, you know, and all that type of stuff in terms of exams. Still there's a focus on exams, but we're looking at processes.
I mean, I'm a lot older than you two, and I have to say, I mean, I think there is some continuity in good teaching in the sense that I do remember, you know, great narratives, great storytelling in the classroom in the 70s when I was at school. And I can remember issues that got us started debates and things like that when we went out the classroom door still engaged. But a lot of it was about factual learning. In fact, my teacher went on a course, and I think I can remember it was 1975, and she came back and she'd been told about sources. And suddenly we had sources. There weren't sources before 1975 in my school. So that was as dramatic as it sounds. So I think there's been a huge change in the way we view evidence and our expectations of young people being able to work with evidence. That's a phenomenal change. And things like you were saying about the enthusiasm of teachers and storytelling, I think it would be wrong to write off everyone before and say they weren't like that, because there were people, but it was very much in that factual narrative framework of history.
You're saying
day.
They were sort of trapped in a mode of teaching history which wasn't always helpful.
Well, yes, we got one tick for one fact, and you know, you got 20 out of 20 if there were 20 facts. I mean, it was as simplistic as that sounds.
So did that get in the way of history being well taught?
Yes, because it was a memory game.
I remember end of year assessments like that, and that was, as I said, that was 10 years ago. I remember an assessment at the end of year 8 that was very much going through and very knowledge based. And I didn't at the time criticise it because I was quite good. I had a good memory, therefore I did well. So is it any better today? Well, in some cases, not always, because there is still a drive in some places for some facts.
Thinking back, and I hadn't thought about this before, we used the SHP American West book at school. And I think if I'd had any other or a much more boring textbook, I don't think I would have enjoyed history as much. My history teacher was Alan Campbell, the MP for Tynemouth. And I did my GCSEs in 1997. And 1997 was the year of the election, and he left to campaign at Christmas. And we had supply teacher after supply teacher until the final thing. So Alan Campbell, if you're listening to this, thank you for me getting a B in GCSE history because, you know, you left. But no, we had this. I mean, Alan was great at kind of telling the story. He was very passionate about his subject. But we did do a lot of textbook work, working through the textbook. But the SHP textbook was so structured and so interesting that actually I enjoyed reading a few pages ahead and finding out things. And even when they said do the activities were different. You know, the old, compare and contrast and interpretations and stuff, rather than just, you know, comprehension activities. So actually, the book as a structure worked well, even though the teacher sometimes left a bit to be desired.
That's a good point, isn't it? That perhaps resources, technology has improved the mediocre teacher to sort of fill the gap, really.
Yeah, it can do.
I was surprised at you saying you had a factual test when you were in year 8. So what year would that be?
That would have been 98?
99,
90. Possibly 97, 98. It's been, I'm useless for that. But no, I do remember it at the end of the year, and it must have been an Industrial Revolution one. And obviously, you know, there's limits to my memory now. I'm sure I'm looking back on it in different ways. But I don't seem to remember there being a big equivalent of an AFL drive. And obviously that was, you know, bubbling under still at that point. That was new. But I just seem to remember that I felt I was doing well with the fact I knew stuff. I had really good memory, so it was fine. And that we went into the classes and I could know stuff and it could go through it. It wasn't all that. There were other examples of activities that were really engaging, but I do remember we had this big end of year, you know, at the end of year you had exam week and all your exams, and I don't remember doing much that I would say was skills or test my skills in year 8.
Do you think there are pupils who actually miss being able to show off their memorising of data?
Yes. There's some kids that just don't see why, you know, they're very proud of that fact that they can get through. They've got that kind of, I know this bit.
I remember being an NQT and going into the school as a consortium of schools. So it was taught, AS history was taught amongst this consortium. And I was sat down and there were 11 of these kids. and I decided, well, we're going to get to know each other, and then we're going to do some group work, and we're going to do interpretations, we're going to sources, we're going to spend a bit of time on that table and everything like that. And they just went, what are you doing? And I said, well, we're doing a bit of group work, we're going to get, you know, a bit of... and I said, I got an A star at GCSE history, right? Just give me the notes, I'll learn them, give me some questions to do, I'll be fine, thank you. Yeah. And, like, I couldn't believe that kids were asking for a boring method of doing things, but it was safe, because they had been successful in that, they knew they could do that, and they thought that AS11 and A2 were just going to be an extension of that, and they could get on and doing that. And certainly when I was at school, there was no group work particularly. In fact, one of the reasons I became a teacher, I was never going to become a teacher. My dad was deputy head of my school. There was no way I was going to be a teacher. But, you know, university, you're talking about light and fires, really did. I had this wonderful philosophy. I did philosophy at university. Did at Sheffield, this guy, Stephen Macon. Just the most inspirational guy in the whole world, I think. And he really kind of lit that fire for learning. And so I finished university and I thought, I'm gonna become a teacher and I'm gonna do history. And I want to change things. And actually, I've now gone back and to the academy, which replaced my school, which is it's going to mean that I'm working with teachers that actually taught me, and in some ways I'm going to be more senior than them, which is going to be a bit strange, but kind of having to change their ideas of what teaching's all about and what learning's all about. So it's going to be a very interesting time, and hopefully they've already developed, and hopefully what I'm saying is just reinforcing what they've already done. But certainly my passion for education wasn't fired at school, it was fired at the university.
Though I think there was a patch earlier that I think we ought to address, that the suggestion that it's kind of either factual learning or source skills. And I think there was a patch in the 80s and 90s when you sort of did sources or you did facts. And I hope and I think we've come out the other end of that, because of course they have to know facts now. But sources at the way forward is to use them in an inquiry, as not artificially as separate things. I think there was an unfortunate sort of death by sources with double spreads in textbooks where you went through, you know, how useful is source A and those kind of dire things. But I think we are coming out the other end of that. But I wouldn't like it to give the impression that children now don't have to learn facts in history, and it's just what they do with the facts and how they use facts.
It's for a purpose, I suppose, yeah.
So maybe it's just I wasn't aware of how we were using the facts as well to some extent. It's difficult also, kind of, you know, reflecting back on it when you weren't necessarily doing that as people, you know, I'm sure we weren't just, certainly wasn't rote learning of a set of facts to the test. It was using them, but I don't know if you necessarily see that clearly. Sometimes that certainly not wasn't an explicit part of it. It was very much for memory thing. I don't remember, the biggest story is the kind of topics. I remember kind of doing within kind of primary school base as well. And I remember having that interest much further on. We were taught topic rather than history, geography. It was down as topic. And I remembered enjoying the kind of history topics more than I enjoyed things like look at a bird, colour in a bird lives in a pond style topics. I wasn't quite aware of the distinction of subjects between history and geography, and things like port, sunlight and industry confused me a bit, but I still had an awareness that actually some of the story ones and the Victorian type things were more interesting as a topic than birds. Didn't understand.
I don't know
birds.
If you had any experience of having non-specialist teachers over a long period of time when you were at school. We had first, middle and high schools when I was at school. Right. And my middle school teacher, we had humanities as a subject. He was a geography teacher. He was not interested in history at all. We did like one lesson of history in the entire year. I did geography for the entire time. But it wasn't general geography. It was basically, this is my passion. I like doing anthropology and tribes, and we're going to do all about that. It was very interesting for half a term, and then it was very boring because it's the same thing, but in just different ways. I just wondered about non-specialist teachers and whether that had turned you off in any subjects, or history in particular.
Not only at primary school, where everything is obviously mixed up. I have to admit, I did my PGCE up at Newcastle, and seeing the kind of first, middle, high section really was just a completely new way of looking at things. There were a few jobs that kept, whether the jobs that came up in the area early on in my course, they were all in high school starting at year 9.
Yeah.
And I just didn't even consider applying for them, because I was just like, I don't really understand quite how you do history to a group of kids for a year who may not have had it, who may not have had any specialist history teaching. I understood it in the year 7 to 9 context. I had 3 years to kind of go, you've done some stuff in primary school, but we're now doing proper history.
What it meant was, whatever your decision for history was based on who you had in year nine.
Yeah.
Because if you had a good teacher in year nine, you chose GCSE history. If you had a bad teacher in year nine, you had to own the experience you've got, so you don't choose it.
Yeah, and that's what I meant. That's what confused me about the kind of history specialism. It's with that, I mean, is that an improvement, the fact that we're now, the kids now get 3 years usually of specialist history teaching in not so much all cases, but probably the majority? If you ask, the majority of this country is now secondary schools rather than first, middle, high. Is that an improvement?
Well, do they?
Or is it potentially?
Do they get 3 years of history in most secondary schools? Because they're moving away from that, seems to me.
Moving away from it, is that one of the futures where it's possibly getting worse?
Last school did humanities in year nine. So, GCSE humanities in year nine. So, integrated kind of thing.
Do you think that technology has been a factor in improving teaching of history?
Has technology improved teaching? I've always said any presentations I've done to teachers is technology is not a silver bullet, but it's actually a very effective silver sword in the hands of the right people.
Oh, silver sword.
Silver sword. I have seen some schools have loads of money for technology and the teachers just do basic PowerPoints, and they're actually, they still believe that they're waiting for a PowerPoint to be proved as a proven technology in the classroom at that level. And then you have teachers who are in schools where they have no resources at all, but they're absolutely doing amazing stuff, kind of flying by the seat of their pants, with kind of bringing stuff in at the last minute and doing great stuff. It comes down to a teacher. If a teacher is willing to try things out, I'm not even looking at technology, because even my own teaching career, the best classes, if you ask my students, had no technology at all. Like the time we made our own tunnel in the classroom and at Rome Desserts, no technology there, but there were good lessons, good classes. So technology in the right hands will improve the teaching of history. Depending on the resources that they're using, good resources can cover up some of the deficiencies in teacher if it's structured in a way where the teacher can literally just go in, deliver a class and get a good end result at the end of it. Where a teacher has to put a lot of work into getting something to work the way they want it, then you're relying on the ability of the teacher to do a good job.
I think it's a lot to do with access. The difference between when I was younger and now is that if I'm a teacher and I've never taught something before and I need resources, and if I need images, you know, click of a mouse or whatever, or if I need to read up on something, I can find it very easily. Or if I'm a student and I'm really interested in something, I go and find out about it. If I want to do that when I was 12, I had to go down to the library. I'm not going to the library to do something like that. Or if I do, you know, I might be short, or I have to find the right book and all this. Whereas when I can just get things very, very quickly and easily, then yes, it means that I'm going to learn better, and it means that my teachers have access to materials which are going to hopefully help me, you know, to teach me better as well.
There are lots of teachers doing really exciting things like Doug with technology. It's just transforming learning. But there are two ways I've seen quite frequently, which in some ways I think are retrograde steps. I mean, people have talked a lot about PowerPoint, and in some ways I think there's more passive learning than there was 5 years ago when it was less pervasive. Because a lot of PowerPoint is lots of text and basically note taking. It's going back really with A-level to dictated notes in a slightly different form. And the other thing is a lot of quick fix sort of gimmicky quiz type things, which sometimes can have a place, but they're often used at the beginning of the lesson, and I feel they're sending the message that the main thing history is about in this lesson is remembering 10 facts about whatever, and in some ways that's going back to my history when I was growing up, which was learn 10 facts about. So I'm not saying those things are always dreadful, but I think when used unintelligently, e-learning can sometimes actually regress the progress we've made in teaching and really thinking about developing thinking. But in the right hands are such amazing things you can do.
So is that just good teaching is about variety rather than a diet the same? Because you're saying in the part, you know, you're saying previously there was textbook work and that was lesson in every lesson.
I mean, if you did like
nowadays we have more space for variety, whether it's using some technology, whether it's using these more, you know, active sessions. and still using textbooks, and it's the variety that makes the difference rather than
absolutely.
The particular skill.
You could do active, you could do source work every lesson, that'd be boring. You could do active learning every lesson, that'd be boring. You could do, you know, what initially will be very fun e-learning stuff, and that would be boring after a while.
Yeah.
It is spicing things up and using the particular tool for, you know, for the right job. And if you don't, it might be an e-learning thing, it might be an active learning thing, it might be writing something down, it might be acting something out, whatever, but it's the right tool for the job. And there's going to be many tools probably for one job, but it's having that repertoire, isn't it? And I think teachers nowadays probably do have a bigger repertoire because there's perhaps a few more CPD opportunities. I mean, obviously, it's difficult for me to compare since I wasn't a teacher then, but probably more CPD opportunities. And just the making connections online. For example, the T-shirt I'm wearing says, Eat, Sleep, Tweet, and that's because I'm on something called Twitter, which I've been on for 2 years. You know, John's on there as well. And I meet up with John on a... John's in Ireland, and it's the first time I met... Is the first time I met first?
In May last year.
Oh, yeah. But we meet almost every Sunday night for this kind of virtual meeting thing, and you know, that's kind of CPD opportunities. We're going to that voluntarily, and there's opportunities like that that just weren't around, you know, 10 years ago for doing that type of stuff.
It'd be interesting to see what the agenda of the first conference was like. I was just tapping in to sit and watch your badges. This is the 21st year of this in action. People have been coming to things like this to learn how to teach history for most of my life.
Yeah.
Does that mean I've just grown up with excellent history teaching? I mean, I suppose it's then looking at the vehicles, so it kind of does spread through history teachers as a whole.
You seem to be saying, though, that the teacher's still at the centre of the process. Because I'm sure there were some people when IT came in, ICT, thought this will reduce the need for teachers because we'll have experts doing excellent content, it'll all be there, and it'll just...
But although we haven't had an explicit, which we do need, an explicit public debate about what the purpose of education is, it has surreptitiously changed, hasn't it, from we need to recall fact to we actually need to be able to do something and be creative and all that type of stuff. And because the goals have changed, you know, the goalposts have moved from fact and retention and passing exam, well, still passing exams, but, you know, knowledge-based exams to process and all that type of stuff, then because the goalposts have changed, then what you've been talking about there in terms of, well, we can now replace teachers by basically automatons and ICT type of stuff, we can't, because you're actually looking at a different process and a different goal, and you can't get there through just sitting a kid in front of a computer all the time.
What's the essential thing that the teacher gives then?
It's the guiding element, isn't it? It's the kind of, it's the life experience, and it's the kind of, you're going to come across this problem, or have you ever considered this, or, well, have you compared that with that? The type of the human element, the computer can never, ever do that.
It's human responsiveness. Mm. Like, ICT can be responsive to, you know, if a child's not getting this, you can provide that support below it, that kind of thing. But that's not got the very human level of, why has the child not got this particular thing? What is the child needing to take to the next stage? That kind of response, but...
Specifically in relation to history, though, are there additional reasons why it's important to have the teacher involved?
Well, because it is.
It's about debate and argument. Mm-hmm. It's not about working out that 5 and 5 is 10.
And it's about people, isn't it? I mean, and I know all great teachers use their own life experience in the classroom in different ways. Your own experience of life, what's been on the news that night, what book you're reading. Mm. And so you are the personality at the front of the class, engaging with them as individual persons too, and that human thing is so vital for motivation and engagement. A computer screen can't ask you, you know, how your mum is and
ad lib and you know, kind of the throwaway comments that actually stick with you, because it's a throwaway comment that reveals a conceptual process in the teacher and a way of looking at the world that you'd, as a 14-year-old, you haven't even thought about, and they've just made this throwaway comment, and it completely changes your world, you know, and you think, oh my goodness, that's just changed everything I've thought about. And you remember those, and there's no way that a computer can do all that type of stuff. So.
So do you think that nowadays there's enough time to do that compared with the case when you were at school?
I get the same hours I did when I was at school. I teach the same hours that I did at school in year 7, slightly less at year 8. When I was at school, we had 4 hours a week in Key Stage 3, right the way through. School and teaching at the moment, we've got 4 hours in year 7, four hours a fortnight. Year 7, we've got 4 hours a fortnight. It's for year 8 and 9, it's gone down to 3. I don't remember the comparison at GCSE or at A-level, to be honest.
I was teaching schools in comprehensive schools in the 70s and 80s, and then there was quite good guarding of curriculum time for subjects, but I think it's changed a lot in more recent times. I'm now in a sixth form college and we get generous amounts of time for teaching A-level, but that's a slightly different kettle of fish.
Well, in my previous school we had a situation where we had 4 50-minute lessons at GCSE, which is actually not bad at all, but in year seven it was 2 lessons a week, 2 50-minute lessons, but 8 and 9 was only 1 50-minute lesson a week. And I would contend that actually you're probably doing more damage than good by only giving them that amount of time. I'd much rather see a term of history where you have 3 times a week and then don't do any for the other 2. I'd much rather have that, because you can go in depth, you're getting a real sense of period, rather than, well, we've got a test coming up in 3 weeks' time, so I better make sure you get through all this stuff, because otherwise you're not going to look very good on the test, that type of thing. So, I mean, other teachers might prefer different options, but I'd much rather have, even if it's for a shorter period of time, a more in-depth and more lessons in a week. I think that'd be much better.
Did you have obviously much more flexibility teaching obviously in the 70s before the curriculum and subjects? I mean, how is the content
when I started teaching in 1983 we started with cavemen and by the end of year 9 we'd reached the Reformation but that wasn't uncommon and there was no national curriculum obviously so things have
that's what
changed.
I meant in terms of the different house significance. I mean, has that made your teaching better or worse, do you think?
I think that the national curriculum generally was a very good thing, because when pupils move between schools, they'd often end up repeating exactly what they'd done before, because each school could do exactly their own thing. Yeah. And the lack of regulation, I think, in many cases led to pretty poor practice by non-specialists. There was a humanities course, actually, back in 1984 it was introduced. So I do feel we've come full circle, because I know that for humanities and theme-based teaching, I think is an in thing now. So. When you're my age, you've sort of seen it all, really.
Actually, it's been round twice. There was one in the 60s as well, humanities surge. So. Yeah.
History's got to make a strong argument for itself in cross-curricular working. We've just done a cross-curricular week based around Africa with the Year 8, and the History Department took a session on with Humanities College, so it seemed natural that obviously we were involved in it. But actually, when there was the evaluation survey given to the whole year, 13 pupils said that the history session was the worst thing, which put us in the top 5 things of it. And that was really, in some senses, quite painful as well, because, you know, we had spent considerable time, we'd got the variety of activities, and while 17 out of 280 isn't a huge number, it's that we weren't quite as flashy and dancy as people outside African drumming, or making big colourful shawls, or it was in cross-curricular working. Sometimes, I don't know if competing is really the word, because that's not the image I'm trying to go for, but we were competing against the music department, which had African djembes in and were sitting out in the playground learning basic drum beats, and I certainly felt we were giving a much more integrity-led inquiry.
Yeah, the kids see those type of days as a bit of a jolly, don't they? That's the thing.
Yeah, and the fact that they were off for the whole week doing this.
Oh, the week.
It was a week off curriculum doing, and we had them for about 2 hours, I think, the history session was. But they just didn't see that. As I said, it's only 17, so whether that's how you look at that, that's about 10% of our year.
Nowadays, do you think that history teachers have to be more flexible and kind of not just wedded to their specialism as much as they used to be in the past?
Sorry, what do you mean?
So, for example, my kind of experience has been that you have to be teaching usually probably more than one subject, and that you have to be flexible to be doing these kind of special days and doing cross-curricular links and learning to learn and all this type of stuff. Do you think that's actually different from how it was in the past? Do you think teachers are a bit more flexible and not specialised? They're not specialised, but they have to do things as well as their specialty. And do you think that's a better thing or worse thing?
I've been quite lucky in my first year in having an entirely history-based timetable. My department's been very supportive at kind of going through, and it's been kind of, for my NQT year, it's been very guided in. So I've started off with a year 10 class. Next year I'll be having a year 10 and 11. Down the future there's going to be space for the A-level. But that's certainly not been the experience of a lot of people I was on course with. Mm. A lot of the people I've been PGC with are teaching a huge range of things, are going at the deep end, sometimes without that kind of full support. I've got one friend who's the only history, one ex-colleague, I guess, who's the only history teacher now in her department. She's an NQT, she's the only history teacher, and her NQT target for the year was to establish a GCSE course ready to be started in her second year because they weren't doing a GCSE. There wasn't enough demand for it at that time. So I think with history losing some of that, I mean, one of the reasons I've got it is A, we're a humanities college, therefore there is some space in it, but B, we're just a large school. We have a large department. Yeah. There is much more space for them to say, well, actually, you know, how are we going to kind of mould you into a good history teacher before we have to kind of let you out there and deal with some of the bigger cross-curricular work?
It deals with the circumstances of the school. If you're in a small school,
yeah,
you're going to have to be more flexible. Because if you're in a 1,000 or 1,500 people yeah. school, you can, if you're lucky enough, you can get pretty much your own subject and that's it. But yeah. if you're in a small school, there's one teacher I know in Ireland, he's teaching 5 separate subjects.
Yeah.
Because of the way it's broken down. But he's unusual in that he's got a background that allows him to do that. But he's 5 different subjects. And that's on the curriculum that he's teaching.
Yeah. I'm not convinced it's changed that much. I mean, I started in 1983 and I'm starting a tough comprehensive and I had to teach CSE English. This is how ancient I am. And by December, I was total mincemeat. I didn't really have any background or training to teach CSE English. I also at that school had to teach drama. They even tried to persuade me to teach music, which really is funny. I think that, you know, the pressure to teach other subjects and fit in around the school is probably a quite perennial problem for history teachers. And I'm not sure that they're respected separate subjects.
The thing I was trying to get out was whether the influence of being in more than one department or having to do all these things made history teaching better, or whether it was actually history being the kind of, you know, because the experience I get from the SHP conference seems to be that history is where the fantastic teaching's at, and that we're kind of doing the evangelism for the subjects, and which way around it was, whether it was good ideas coming from elsewhere into there, or whether history ideas were going out, and it seems to be the latter.
So that history teachers are influencing teachers in other disciplines.
Yeah, for example, the session I went to, was it today or yesterday, I was talking about if you have to go down the road of personalising learning and thinking skills and, you know, mishmash of a curriculum and all this type of stuff, then really you need to take the lead and use your historical skills to make sure that what they're doing is worthwhile and rigorous and all that type of stuff. But actually, that is the experience of even before this, what was going on. History teachers would then go out and say, well, this is what I'm doing in history, you know, even e-learning stuff, this is what you should be doing in other subjects. It's a similar type of thing you can do.
But do other subjects make the same arguments about the skills that they bring in as well? I mean, that's the thing I've got, you know,
I know some maths teachers do that.
I don't know, but there is, I mean, when we were doing our training, the maths PGC lecturer, in terms of maths CPD, was really, really good with it. He was so focused. He was taking us for mixed workshop. But he was on some of those, I suppose, the cutting edge of maths teaching, really, and those kind of forums for sharing things. And things like this from a maths base. And we have a pretty self-selected lot who have essentially encouraged the school to spend some money on us to come away and spend a weekend being history geeks. And that's fine, but that is a relative... I mean, if you look at the thing, there's me out of Chester, Cheshire as a whole region, there's me and my head of department who's come from Cheshire. Now, in all reality, that's not that much as a percentage of history teachers in Cheshire. And I think you can do that in quite a few areas. There's no one on there specifically from Newcastle apart from the museums. There's some excellent history teachers in Newcastle, but that kind of thing. We're coming from a very self-selected kind of
history teachers are great. You have to be very careful of thinking this conference is in any way typical. And as a parent, I have to say, you know, I remember my son in year 9, which must be about 6 years ago now, and his final project to assess what level he was a project on the Holocaust, and the brief from the teacher was write 6 pages about the Holocaust. So he wrote 6 pages about the Holocaust and it was marked as level 7. I don't know if it's because he had some nice pictures in there, but it was certainly nothing to do with the historical thinking. So I think you do need to remember that there is some quite poor history teaching out there.
And that comes back full circle to what we were talking about at the beginning, but my point is that history is often seen as, from what I gather, as being one of the best taught subjects in schools.
Yes.
So perhaps the bar is slightly higher.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure you're right. Yes.
I'm just thinking that some schools, you know, maybe it's not in your school, or that there are maths teachers that are on the cutting edge of what it means to be a good mathematician. Or
my dad's head of department maths. He's retiring this year. He's been fantastic. He's driven results where he's been. He's been on the cutting edge of all these different types of things. But his he would say himself that his what he would do in maths, if he tried to do that in history, not even close to, you know. Whereas if I took history ideas and put them in maths, that would work. So.
I think one of the kind of benefits of not being in the classroom at the moment is I actually get a chance to see primary school teachers and a lot of secondary school teachers in their classroom quite a bit of time, or even get a chance to talk to them. Even for my own, if I was to go back to teaching in next month or 2 months' time, I have actually picked up an awful lot from other teachers who are teaching different subjects and different levels by the conversations I've been having with them, especially on the area of using technology, because geography teachers come up with some ideas about using technology that, as a history teacher, I wouldn't have taught.
Mm.
And it's kind of given me ideas, okay, well, yeah, that might work if I was doing such and such a topic. Like, there is some very good maths teachers out there, because maths is a very hard subject to teach, and it's very easy to see very good maths teachers and very bad maths teachers, where in history it might be a little bit more difficult to kind of sort out the good from the bad. It's obviously in school who's got the best maths which teachers are the best maths teachers and which are the weaker ones. Mixing ideas from other teachers is always beneficial, I think, and I wouldn't wholly agree with that a maths teacher could come into a history class, because you'd be surprised what some teachers can do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question is, do you think that the opportunities for, you know, learning from other people's practice have improved over time or lessened?
I'm meant to, as part of my NQT year. It's one of the things I'm meant to spend my NQT 5 hours a fortnight doing. And my head of department encouraged it, both seeing people outside the department and trying to see other people in the department. But with the amount of other pressures that have been going on, it's just, I think it's happened twice. And they both have been really interesting.
Well, you do get that when you're training and during NQT year, but after that, it just stops. It's like a cliff, you know, you just go from doing some stuff to just none at all. You don't get to observe anyone else in a normal situation.
He wants us to do it within the department. He wants us to see at least one other person in the department. Because he said that in his role was having to come round and observe lessons, and we've just had interviews in. And he said that one of the best things for him in seeing the interviews wasn't only, you know, seeing some candidates, but actually seeing some really good examples of teaching. And he's the view that it shouldn't just be him that gets to see that, because actually, as a department, we all want to improve our own practice. But that is only internally. We have started to try and get links with other departments. So we've started trying to make a few technology links with MFL, because I think we've only just had our smart boards installed. MFL have had them for a while and use them really well. Like, in terms of, we went through a training and it was absolutely fantastic, and it was just, I don't know, maybe it's the skills of teaching language in terms of,
but there, you tend to find that with MFL teachers,
isn't it? It really was. But it's now trying to secure some of those links. So I had like a question of sports setup style board with it for the thing. I was like, that'd be perfect for MFL. It didn't take me that long to set up the template, so I just,
the thing which is really unfortunate is that lesson observations are so tied to performance management, that's pretty much absolutely the only thing that happened. Whereas if it was normal for teachers to come into your classroom just to drop in and see what you're up to and that type of thing, which has been tried to be encouraged in some of the departments I've been in, if it's a natural everyday thing that people come in, just watch you start and go, oh, it's a good idea, I'm going to try that now and go off, then you don't tend to want to close your door and kind of have my own little place, thank you very much, and be very wary when other people come in.
There's a growth for that from AFL audits. We've recently, our AFL walk learning group has been taking the idea of the learning walk, that as the AFL rep of our department, that he should, you know, one of his tasks is to make sure that he visits other classrooms, takes two students at random to have a quick talk about, you know, do they know what they're learning, that kind of thing. And I have to admit, it's a really challenging one, because on one hand you're sitting there going, well, actually you're doing this as CPD because you're checking that the kids are doing something, and if they're not, we're trying to think, well, actually, how can it do? And it's okay, because actually he's a pretty sound guy, and in terms of going through, it's an open dialogue there. But would I be as comfortable with that if that was coming from someone senior? Possibly more with a...
And what about if you're close to the end of your career, you've never been used to that, you see that the person who's doing it is only out for political gain and furthering their career, you wouldn't want them in your classroom.
This is it. It's a really difficult one to balance. I think he's doing it out of genuine concern, but that is through... that's where he's been doing his research recently, that is. I don't think he's up for... He's very keen that he's not up for promotion at the moment. It's not something he's interested in, but it's very difficult to actually... my immediate reaction was to go, you're just going to come into my classroom and randomly pick two kids.
But if it happens, well, it's an accident, isn't it? It's not actually, it's not planned into the whole kind of CPD for staff. And really, there needs to be, you will spend one lesson every fortnight, month, whatever, observing another teacher in another department and
that's
make people do it.
That's going to be a lot harder now with the rally cover things coming into play. Although the impact that that's going to have on rally cover, union rules. I don't know much about it. It's the workplace agreement.
It depends how it's interpreted by school, I suppose.
Yeah, workload agreement's gone past, and from this September, you should only be asked to cover in extreme emergency and unplanned for emergency. So if a teacher has fallen over and had to go home at period two, you could be, you know, it would be reasonable if you got asked to cover once during the year for periods 3, 4, or 5. But if someone, teacher just rang up in the morning and went, I'm sick, that wouldn't be a reasonable rally cover. And that's going to have impact though on opportunities for you to turn around and then say, well, actually somewhere in my timetable I should have a chance to cover. Either you leave that as an unprotected, that needs to be as a free period that's not being protected in that kind of way, or
well, it's going to cost the school money in terms of supply, definitely. But just the way it is.
Well, one thing that has improved is the things like the internet and the school's history forum, which you take part in a lot, don't you? I mean, certainly now, I wouldn't have thought of doing this a few years ago, but if I'm really stumped and starting a new module or something, I'd probably turn to that and type that into the search engine and ask people, help, I'm doing this.
It's just made sharing so much easier, hasn't it? I mean, just the everything that I've done, I mean, I'm now director of e-learning, everything stemmed from Rachel Jukes, who's here. She we're on the same PGC course that we've done, and although I was aware of the forms, I'd read them, I didn't really want to get involved because I thought it was a bit geeky and a bit sad, but I did, I got involved, and it was a wonderful way of sharing because everyone shares everything on there. I set up a website to help that even more happen, historyshareforum.com, and so everyone just shares everything, and now it's so inbuilt into myself and other people there that when you share something, you automatically, when you make something, you automatically share it with everyone else because you know you're going to get back like 10-20-fold what you've given out there.
And easier perhaps because they're people from other schools, they're not people you're going to see every day.
Because we don't even have it fully integrated in our department. Again, that's one of our departmental onward style goals, really, is that actually there is really good teaching going across the department, that but there's no formal method of communication. You know, it just tends to be informal chit chat or me running through going, I've never taught this before, I don't know what I'm doing, please help me.
I think what it's the same with everything to do with, you know, history teaching, e-learning. If you don't put systems in place, then it's either dependent on an individual or just happens accidentally. And so what happens, I mean, just using an analogy in kind of the e-learning sense, you might have someone who's really up for it, or you might have someone who's really up for history teaching and new ways of doing things. If they don't embed what's going on in the schemes of work, in the policies and procedures, they move on and the department just sinks because it's all dependent on that particular person. And it's a real shame.
Yeah, but also about nurturing other people to continue what they've been doing.
But there needs to be systems in place to do that. It shouldn't be kind of just left for, you know, as an accident. There needs to be more than just, you know, kind of noises made. There needs to be actually something delivered.
And one of the skills I taught in, it was a kind of an official practice that you would team teach with newly qualified teachers or PGCs in the school, that if you were free and you were yourself and the teacher were discussing something, that you do go and do something together and you team teach. So it depends on the school. It was just the case that there'd be a certain kind of cohort of teachers would kind of volunteer to do it, and if the timetable allowed it, that they were both free at the same time, or if the senior teacher or a teacher willing to take help the other teachers were free at the same time, did go in and did do something with them. Like with me, it was using technology, so I would go in with any teacher really, say, okay, well, we're doing something now, and I'd be there and make sure everyone was working, and then we'd kind of bounce between us how we were teaching the lesson, so we could be doing some sort of resource on online, and I'd be thrown out at some point. And like, it wouldn't necessarily even be my subject, but even, say, for French, there'd be some point I could make from a technology point of view, and that was a valid question to ask them, and then the French teacher would extend it on, so therefore there was an interaction from two teachers, but it wasn't very common
I got to joint plan once on my placement. It was one of our assignments for the master's module, and we had to joint plan with our mentor or someone senior in the department, and then we both had to deliver the lesson to different sets of pupils, and she got to observe me and make some comments, and I got to observe her, and it was one of the most influential things of my training, because it was just absolutely fantastic. She was making some of the criticisms in her evaluation of me that I'd had on placement before, or I'd heard before, thought about before, but hadn't really got that idea of actioning how to do it. And she just was like, you didn't do that bit very well there. This, you know, that's something for you to focus on, evaluation. And it wasn't a negative thing. I mean, obviously it was a lot more gentle and reassuring than that.
Yeah.
But it was actually, it was just one of those moments. I just remember sitting there watching her do the lesson that I'd taught the day before, the lesson that we'd both had a part in planning. It was literally us both having a part. It just wasn't her coming in and saying, this is what you should be doing. I was like, let's write that all down. It was a joint planned lesson, but just watching her doing it and having attempted to do it myself, I was like, that makes sense now. Yeah, and those kind of learning opportunities from that, so you know, that's a fantastic, that's a really nice idea, that kind of.
I think if you went back 20, 30 years, that would be completely revolutionary. Mm. There wouldn't be any idea of doing that. Can I just introduce a different, slightly different topic and just ask you whether you think content is a factor, the actual, you know, knowledge that you teach, the topics that you're teaching is a factor in history being better taught today than in the past? The subject's just inherently better, is it? The course is better designed?
I'd guess there's less place for specialist interest. Well, that's something we were told, that, you know, that was something a reflection our PGC drew to me, that he'd, you know, whilst he felt he was, you know, it meant that all departments, as you said, from all schools were delivering a standard set of information, it didn't give as much space for that kind of passion of the history teacher if yours was outside of this set curriculum. He said that's one of the benefits, really. It is reflection, and that's one of the benefits of the more open curriculum from 2007, that actually it gave a lot less prescribed content. So it's kind of trying to retain some of the better bits of before the curriculum, the without actually losing the benefits.
The drive for kind of value added and exam results and league tables has meant, for example, that my previous school ditched the SHP, even though it was better history, for the OCR Modern World, because they got better results in that. And you're kind of thinking,
there are market forces at work, because we're competing with other subject areas, which led to an awful patch when, certainly at A-level, it was not Susan Henry the VIII, mostly. Mm. I think we might be coming out the other side. I don't know, I'm not convinced that topic areas matter that much, except I do think it's really important that we have a more global perspective than we used to, and that Chinese and African history and things like this are brought in more. But whenever I'm preparing to teach something new, I sometimes groan and think, oh dear, I'm not really interested in this. But as soon as I start reading about it,
the
game begins to tick.
Yeah.
And you sort of think, oh yes, actually, this is really quite good stuff. So,
now, what I was mentioning
high
about.
School, we did an A-level that was very deliberately not Holocaust Henry, and we were told that, you know, you're not doing this because. And it was at the time that all the news was kind of, you know, universities are fed up with seeing candidates that haven't studied anything but Hitler, that kind of thing. And it was sold to us an options evening as we were a very good history department, we're deliberately avoiding Hitler, and we're doing British political history 1815 to 1881. And I loved it, but I have to admit, it certainly wasn't something for everyone in the class.
No,
it didn't have that same popular grip. I enjoyed it, and I was like, this is actually really nice. And it did then influence further study. You know, I chose a specialist, you know, my dissertation was based on that period, but with a more social factor, because it had, I suppose, it had opened up really what was out there to study. And I think that's important in terms of the breadth of what is actually out there. I mean, you get some schools that, you know, from year nine onwards, they're doing predominantly modern history, and that kind of, you know, that ability to engage with medieval history is just not there in the slightest, because
in the Irish context, the topics and the range of topics we cover is different, because like, it's really opened my eyes today looking at the textbooks in the past 2 days and trying to figure out, okay, I was planning to buy a textbook that would help me as I go back teaching, but your curriculum is you go far deeper. Like, we've, for junior cert cycle, would be probably equivalent to your GCSEs, we do from caveman until more or less the present day, and basically first year it's Celts, Romans, medieval, Renaissance, then second year it's Age of Exploration, American Revolution, French Revolution, 1798, Social History, Industrial Revolution, and you keep moving forward until you come to kind of Second World War and there, and in senior cycle now, the new curriculum come in, but it's pretty much still kind of a lot of topics, but we wouldn't go into as deep as you do over here, and like as well it's kind of mirrored in the subjects, number of subjects that our students have to take. You have to take seven subjects for their leaving cert when you've been doing three for A levels, maybe for A levels. So the Irish system has always been looking at doing a broad amount of things, so therefore you would be covering, and we would cover topics in American history and British history, European history. I was actually going through some old textbooks that my cousin had before I started school, because we changed books the year I started, and it was quite detailed medieval history in the Middle Ages, and it's kind of amazing now to see that the way the curriculum has been changing now to kind of more topics relating to what's happening around the world. Kind of like at the moment now, to what they're teaching in for Leaving Cert History, and the main topic is American and the Cold War and the war and the arms race, which has kind of certain relevance today with Putin and other things and in China. So it's just from the point of view that we would have gone for a very traditional wide area and covered topics, just kind of take the moments like ticking boxes. But personally, I do think that it's probably stood me far better when I went to college, because you had a whole range of different topics to pick from when you went to college. Because if I'd only had three or four distinct topics going into college, you'd be kind of more inclined to stick with what you knew, because you weren't going to go and try off something else.
That's an interesting perspective, isn't it? That in fact, covering more but at less depth actually enables you to go further in more topics. I don't know whether you agree with that.
Yeah, no, I've never done any significant medieval study. Even at university, most of the time, with the way my course was laid out, and because I'd taken a subsidiary module in education, I think my earliest topics was kind of 15th century, possibly 16th. It was kind of a few religious things around.
So kids certainly are, they have to specialise too early. My last school, specialist engineering school, have to do an engineering subject, then two options at 14 years old. I mean, it's a tragedy, really.
When I started teaching in the 80s, I had to do CSE, and it was all social and economic history, so it was Jethro Tull, and of course we're teaching them key facts, multiple choice questions on agricultural inventions, and I have to say I found that dire. But I don't believe in the sort of content being that important, because I think now that if I taught social and economic history, it wouldn't have to be dire, because of the way we'd approach it would be different. But it's interesting that that's gone into quite a decline, the sort of the Industrial Revolution at GCSE and A levels almost disappeared. I think it's very rare now. But when I was in the 80s, that was what everyone did. You know, we all did Jethro Tull and the Spinning Jenny. And that was,
do you think that reflects a change in enthusiasms of history teachers?
I'm not sure that we were that mad about it at the time. There wasn't that much choice, as I remember it, in the exam boards, but I might be wrong, because I was junior at that time and I wasn't making the decisions, but that seemed to be what everyone did. You know?
I think certainly now, if I was head of department, I'd be making at least part of the decision based on who else was doing it, doing the course, just in terms of sharing resources, sharing ideas, kicking those type of things around. Because you've always got to have one eye on what's pragmatic to do. You know, one might be the best history, but if there's a second best history one, which you've got fantastic resources for, well, there you go.
Yeah.
That probably was always an issue, actually. Thank you very much, all of you. We're wanting your dinner now.
Yes.